Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. I am introducing a man who needs no introduction here. John Rapoport, author, investigative reporter, poet, painter, Da Vinci of his day, and one of our greatest heroes. I don't know how many times you've been a hero on the Salieri Report, but it's it definitely makes you a most valued player. So, John, thank you so much for doing this. You, a couple weeks ago, published an article that just totally was like magic. Because what you did is you wrote an article about William Blake, who not only is one of my favorite poets and one of my great heroes, but if you look at what Blake did in the time he did it, it's exactly what we need to hear right now. And I'll explain more about that later. But I said, you know, typical of Rapoport that he would like ring the bell in the deep cultural space that tells us what we need to be doing. So kudos again to you. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write a great article about William Blake.
Well, let's see. You know, I've written about 300 articles about COVID. So it tends to wear down the stone a little bit.
Yep.
You begin to sort of have a very narrow focus relative to what you could be focusing on. So since I'm 17, I've been writing poetry. So that's, I don't know, 65 years or so. And it was my way out.
Right.
When I was 17, and I realized that I was not going to be a left-handed pitcher for the New York Yankees, that was not going to happen, then I had no escape hatch, and I needed one, because everywhere that I looked around me, I was dissatisfied. There was something phony in the culture.
Right.
And it was palpable. And I mean, I wasn't the only one seeing it. There were a lot of kids that were seeing it. What is this all about? I mean, are we just, the world is made up of nothing but sellers and buyers, consumers, and then people parading around because they're selling and succeeding at selling, and somehow this gives them a fantastic badge of honor, and their gods parading around and driving Cadillacs and whatever. And is this it? I mean, you have to fit in with that, or so I was just, you know, refusing. And so I began reading science fiction. I began writing when I was 17, writing poetry. And it just exploded in my mind. And when I got to college, it was a battle to stay with the curriculum, because I was always going to the library. I was taking out a book of Yeats poems and William Blake and so on. And so I guess recently it was a similar urge. I have to break out of this. And what is the culture if it can't accommodate these giants who are on spiritual quests and quests of imagination? It all comes together. And Blake has always seemed to me to be the epitome of that.
Right.
Went to school until he was 10 years old. That was it. Educated by his mother after that. Married a very young girl who was illiterate, educated her. She became his partner for life. And he was an original to the hilt and also a poetic genius. So I went to him to refresh and to say, we can't just say we have to beat the bad guys. Yeah, we have to do that. But toward what end? Where are we going?
So stopping evil is not enough. You have to create love. You have to create the conditions of love. You know, that's the alternative. You know, stopping evil is only a step towards creating the world we want to live in.
Absolutely. Right. And so what I've noticed is a tremendous decline in literacy over the last, say, 30, no, I would say since the early 1960s, I've noticed it because I taught school back then. And so people would look at poetry and say, well, not only am I not interested, but I can't understand what this is all about. I have no idea what's going on here. And that seems to me to be an enormous tragedy.
So one of the things I've thought and talked a lot about over the last 2 years, and it was thanks to Thomas Meyer kind of inspired this. I'd gotten a video of a scientist talking about using mind manipulation as a weapon of war, sort of neurological weapons. And the guy was all excited and giving a presentation to, it was either government or, you know, intelligence agencies or military, all excited about how we can manipulate people's minds as a weapon. And isn't this great and cool? He's very positive, very chipper. And it drove me crazy. And I showed it to Thomas and he said, oh, he's a hypermaterialist. In other words, he only sees the material reality. He does not understand. Okay, you know that that is Robert and Mai's favorite coffee mug. Best day ever. Right. So he's a hypermaterialist, and he does not know that the spiritual and energetic realms exist. And if you go back and look at what Blake and the Romantics did, you know, the Industrial Age was a period of incredible centralization, of technology, which was brutal and throwing people off the land. It was a very brutal time, not unlike what's happening now. And, you know, people losing their land, dying, et cetera. And all the rich guys saying, oh, this technology is great. Let's centralize some more. And the Romantics just basically rejected the entire hypermaterialist vision of that time and said, no, wait, you know, that's not reality. And that's not our reality. And they, you know, I don't know how they did it, but somehow they struck the chord of, wait a minute, there's a spiritual and energetic world, and that's reality. And, you know, including aligning with nature. And they just blew the whole picture on the Industrial Revolution, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Dark satanic mills is right. One of Blake's great phrases, talking about the Industrial Revolution. Right. Dark satanic mills. Yeah. And now, if you look at the contention, well, computers can write poetry, so there's nothing really creative about anything, since they can beat humans at chess and they can write poetry and compose music. So recently, I started reading some computer poems. They are horrendous. I mean, pathetic. These computers, whatever they do, you know, whatever the algorithm is, so they turn out poetry. And these idiots like Kurzweil and so on say, well, see, no problem. We don't need humans for poetry. And then you actually read what the computers are turning out. Wow, it's just horrible. Yeah, there's a unique coming together at that period that you're talking about, the Romantic period, where it's this tremendous spiritual impulse, but with originality, because right. it's saying, we're not saying that you have to sign up for some organized religion here. That's not what we're about. I mean, you think we're writing these fantastic poems to get you to go to a church on Sunday so you can fall asleep during the sermon?
No,
that's not it. And Blake, to me, personifies that to the hilt. And in the article that I wrote, I showed how over the years he wrote many contradictory things about religion and spirit. And
right.
but yet it was always with that unquenchable energy that made him an original. It was his spiritual quest, just like
right.
it has to be everybody's individual spiritual
so
quest.
I would say that he absolutely embraced the notion of a divine intelligence and what I would call the covenant of grace of the New Testament. But what he was saying was, he was saying, you know, this is not for Sunday. This is for your life 24/7. You know, you can integrate this into your life.
He was saying it's for 24/7.
Right.
How you integrate it in your life, I mean, it's going to cause a revolution.
Right.
No question about it. It's not just something you fit in nicely. Because once you start down that path, then you begin overturning all kinds of false idols that
right.
you were formerly worshiping. You know, so it's not going to be a picnic, but it gives you enormous strength that you would not otherwise have to keep on. And I keep on trying to say that in different ways, in different pieces that I write or when I speak to people. You know, this time that we're living in, yes, it's certainly a test of faith, of your individual faith.
Right.
But if you don't have that, in whatever it is that you have the deepest faith in, if you can't find that, how are you going to endure? How are you going to deal with what's happening to us?
You're not going to be able to.
No,
I don't think. Right.
Neither do I. So when people sort of brush it off and say, well, yes, theoretically, I understand what you're talking about. But meanwhile, I have to deal with very practical problems. Yes, but dealing with practical problems only and exclusively on their own terms has diminishing returns. And
right.
eventually you get down to the small end of the funnel where you don't have any strength left. You don't have anything to say. Whatever happens to me, ultimately, it doesn't matter because I have this.
So in a hyper-materialist world, the leadership has set it up so there's one way in and no way out. And faith, wait, so you wrote faith, vision, and imagination, maybe not in that order. But I'll never forget being in church. I was studying spiritual warfare, and I was listening to a sermon, and I was studying your imagination, you know, your first series on imagination, and doing your imagination exercises with great success. And I was listening to the sermon, and I said, oh my God, he's teaching exactly what John Rappaport is teaching. And the scripture he was teaching was, faith is the substance of things hoped for but not yet seen. And what he was describing is, it's like, think of your faith as the raw material you use to build the bricks that you then use to build the cathedral. In other words, the future is created out of your faith, and you do it because you can. I mean, that's why we're here. And so it doesn't start with, well, give me a logical reason why I should have faith. No, that's not it. You create your faith. You pour out your faith because that's what you can use to create what it is you and your creator have decided your purpose is. So get going. What are you waiting for? It's like,
yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
Well, that is exactly right. And right. I think many people don't want to face that because it is going to be a revolution. And nowhere
yes.
is that clearer than looking at Blake, reading his poems.
Right.
What is he saying? What is he asking? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? It took me 25 years to realize he was actually asking that question. I was
right.
so taken by those lines of poetry in themselves, which I would put up against any lines of poetry ever written, period, that I had overlooked the fact that he was asking that question to himself and to anyone else who wanted to listen to, what is this God? You know, this is a mystery that that is only being touched on if you begin to look around you and say, who created all of this? What is this, you know? And I'm just looking at Samant. When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears. Did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Talking about the tiger. I mean, not only is that immortal poetry, but he's asking himself this question, and he answers it in different places and then changes his answers in different places, but it never stops him. He talks about, in one quote here in the article, about how I have the conqueror's force, he's saying basically, and this force I will never give up. But he's not talking about, you know, war of overcoming, you know, populations and killing people and whatever. He's talking about the spiritual war and the war of discovery of what his faith is really all about. And when people who are watching this and listening to it see some of the paintings of Blake that you put up, you'll see how far he goes in pictorializing that universe that he sees, which is whatever you think of those paintings, there's never in the history of painting in the East, the West, the North, or South that look anything like these paintings. That's all.
So I've only seen one painting that reminded me of Blake. I stopped in Colmar several years ago to look at the Isham altar. I think I sent you the pictures. And it's, you know, the painting is hundreds of years old, and yet it looks almost new. And it has that same unbelievably light energy of Blake's paintings. And you think, where did this come from? Where, you know, it's funny because I always think of Blake as a poet, but as a painter, he was phenomenal.
And he was an engraver. And he right. studied and he developed unique techniques for engraving during his lifetime. When I look at the paintings, one of the things, his paintings, what bowls me over is that the action, of which there's a tremendous amount in the paintings, is happening right now.
Right.
I don't feel that I'm looking back into history and seeing, oh, yes, this is a wonderful painting that was done 150 years ago. No, it's happening. These
right
scenes
now.
Are happening right now.
Well, it helps you see. I go back to this plague of hypermaterialism. It helps you see beyond the materialism. It helps you start to see that world, you know, maybe we describe it into the field, but into the field and start to realize, oh, it's real. It's real, and it's a place where I can access intelligence and power.
Right, and I think that's exactly what came across to people of his time and ever
right.
since about him was, in fact, a famous book in, I'm going to say, 1958-60 by Colin Wilson called The Outsider.
Right.
He wrote this when he was 24 years old, and it became a literary sensation. And he composed or wrote much of it living under a bridge in London.
Wow.
It became a literary sensation. Because what he was doing was, chapter by chapter, he was describing a personage that he called the outsider. This is someone who could look, did look at the world and society and see something lunatic about the whole show.
Right.
But could never stop being an outsider and right. paid an enormous price for that. And he talked about some of the literary personages down through history, such as Harry Haller, a character in Hermann Hesse's novel Steppenwolf,
mm-hmm.
who was that kind of outsider. And he, paragraph by chapter by chapter, he showed you examples from Dostoevsky, for example, of people who came closer and closer toward being able to somehow resolve the intense contradiction between having a vision of their own of some kind and being an outsider in terms of society. And the final chapter is about William Blake. Wow. And I read this when I was 22, 23, and the last chapter exploded on me because I was waiting to see, is he going to be able to resolve this contradiction? Because, of course, since I was maybe 12 years old, I felt the same thing. I'm looking in on what's happening here, and it seems to be pretty much a lunatic asylum, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do about it, you know, when I grow up. And it's a smashing final chapter about Blake, that his vision took him into society, through society, out the other end. He just somehow transcended without becoming isolated
right.
because of his faith and his energy and his vision and his imagination.
So you have done an extraordinary body of work on imagination and the power of imagination. Could you just sum up for people? You know, I don't know anyone who's done more to stress and teach the power of imagination, which, of course, is a power. If we're going to reinvent our world, you know, this is because what we're watching across the world is a failure of imagination. We are dealing in a time of profound failure of imagination. So talk a little bit about your work on imagination and how it dovetails with Blake.
One of the first milestones for me was knowledge is not the end all and be all.
Right.
Especially when knowledge seems to imprison you.
Right.
The next sort of phase of that was, if you have a thought that seems to limit you in some way that you don't want to be limited, invent a better thought. Why should you become a prisoner to that thought that limits you, because you have the ability to invent a different thought? And that became a kind of guidepost for me in the worst of times, when I would find myself in a kind of a hole and I would think, well, how did I get here? Well, I could see thought by thought by thought by thought by feeling by thought how I had put myself into that hole. And I said, well, I mean, excuse me, but that seems to be counterproductive, since thoughts are a dime a dozen. You happen to choose some pretty bad ones that put you where you are. So remember, you can invent new ones. And then instantaneously, I was out of the hole.
So I'll never forget, I was... when I worked in the Bush administration, I created a memo of ideas for the secretary. And I was meeting with him later, and he said, aren't you angry at me? And I said, why? He said, because I've stolen all your ideas. And I said, well, that's my job, is to give you ideas. You didn't steal them. They were, you know, I'm trying to create them for you. And he said, yeah, but I keep using them. And I said, well, he said, you know, and I've basically expropriated them, and I've claimed credit for it. And I said, good, that, you know, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. And then he said, but don't you feel like I'm stealing them? I said, no, just invent more. And he looked at me and he it was a look of pure jealousy. I was shocked. I had no idea that he thought of ideas as scarce. And one of the things I've always been stunned at is that anybody would think that the well is finite. It's not. It's infinite.
Another milestone. The well is infinite.
Right.
There's no limit to what you can do with imagination. And for those people who say, I have no imagination, my rejoinder has always been, well, imagine that you do. And that works just as well. That's just as good. So you don't have any imagination. Okay, that's not a problem, see, because you can imagine that you do. Really?
Yeah. Well, but something, there's been some kind of brainwashing.
Yeah.
That we don't have the power to invent and create our world. I'll never forget, when I started Hamilton, I first ran into this. I had people working for me who were so talented, so bright, everything. And I remember once we were trying to figure out I wanted to do something very innovative in terms of calculating the winnings of mortgage. We were doing these billions of dollars in mortgage auctions. And so I decided, okay, well, let's get an optimization model. And we pretty quickly figured we didn't have the internal capacity to build one. And I said, well, we'll just identify the people in the world who make the greatest optimization technology, and then we'll figure out how to apply it to a mortgage loan sale. We'll just invent the process. And they got really angry at me. It's like, you can't just go invent something new. I was like, don't be ridiculous. Of course I can. I'm from New York. In New York, everything always started with yes. Yes, we can build a bridge to the moon, but it'd be expensive, but you always start it with yes. And I discovered that I was surrounded by these bright, intelligent, capable, talented people who somehow had been given a mental prison to persuade them they weren't allowed to invent anything new. I have no idea how that happened, but it was significant.
Very significant.
Right.
Education system to me has a whole lot to do with that, because the people who run the system, who teach in the system, the bureaucrats and so forth, they're all invested in what already exists. I mean, that's their ticket. They teach knowledge. Yeah. This is what we've already come to understand is true. And I know what that is, and you don't. So I'm going to teach it to you, and that's why I can cash my paychecks.
Right.
So if somebody comes up and says, well, I can imagine something different, that's a threat right away. Right. And unconsciously, everybody knows this, but nobody wants to deal with it. Because, I mean, take economics, for example, a course, fortunately, I never took in college, because this seemed like the worst idea in the world. But I know that the professor who taught the course or courses, there's this system, and then it was superseded by this system, and then this system. So we've got to learn what these are and so forth and so on. And I made a suggestion, not directly to the professor, but sort of through somebody else. What about imagining a completely different system? And it was like, we have a terrorist on campus here. We have to do something about this, right? Excommunicate him. Because the truth is, if you opened up the classroom to students and said, look, okay, so now you know what we've done so far with economics and civilization, but now we're going to spend the next semester on inventing systems, and each one of you is going to invent a better system.
Right, exactly.
Or many, we're going to get into that and really, force young people to imagine other systems,
right?
Knowing that some of these are going to be, kind of crazy. And so, well, who cares? Just invent more.
Right.
And then at the end of the year, that's something that those students will remember the rest of their lives, because they're going to realize, well, I've got imagination.
Right.
Well, this never happens in high school and college and whatever, you know. And I think that's one reason why people start settling for limitation.
Right. Well, let's face it, Blake was homeschooled, right? Leonardo da Vinci was self-taught. I mean, there's a reason these things happen. Okay, so this week on the Blast from the Past, every week we bring up something from the archives to remind new subscribers that it's there. We're going to bring up The Power of It with John Rappaport. I don't know if you remember our recording that, but it was our effort to remind people, you know, that there is a enormous spiritual and energetic field, and they can access it, and it can give them power.
I remember that. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, because I love it so much, and I'm going to forget the name, is your recording, the one I always listen to on my long car drives. It's at the Age of Merlin.
Yeah, that's right. It's not exactly what it was, but it's close enough. The Age of Merlin, exactly.
Right, and you take us back historically in our imagination. You know, we live through a world that's constantly centralizing and trying to produce what I would describe as the economic dividend. And you take us back to a world where we were much more free without the, you know, sort of first the agriculture, then the industrial, now the technology. You know, we keep seeing a centralization going on with technology, which is producing a bigger and bigger creation of wealth or a dividend to a centralized power, but in the meantime is limiting our ability to use imagination more and more and more. And you take us back to what you described as the Age of Magic, and it's phenomenal because you literally, in your mind, you go back there, you walk around it, you can feel it. I don't know how you do this, but I always, on a long car drive, because it's like 6 hours, you know, I think I want to visit the Age of Magic, so I'll put on the Age of Merlin and I'll go back there. And so maybe just talk a little bit about your notion, because in this, what you're describing is what we all have the capacity to do.
It happens spontaneously to start with. I don't know how I did that particular piece. It was something about Merlin. I thought, I just want to talk about this archetype of Merlin the magician. And I started talking about it. And then I sort of thought, okay, let me just make this into a world that we were once in, where, for example, the transmitting of emotions between people was much more vivid without the need for language.
Mm-hmm.
So that mood and emotion passed between people like, you know, putting a credit card into a machine or it was just every day this was happening all the time. And
right.
That these emotions, it wasn't that, you know, oh, well, what about a negative emotion? No, it was more like paintings, as if you could telepathically transmit paintings of different moods and colorations and sensations among people without having to even speak, so that
the world
is alive with that energy.
The scientists say that dolphins communicate with pictures. They literally, right.
So it's not so far-fetched at all to me. And on top of that people had certain innate powers, which they still have, but they were able to express them, to change physical reality, to make it different, to change your landscape, and so on. So you had sort of a an interpenetration of realities among people who were living in communities where they began to see that they were making exchanges of artistic productions that were alive in the physical world. It wasn't just, you know, somebody alone with his thoughts in a room. It was happening all the time.
One of my favorite videos a couple years ago, I don't know if I ever sent it to you, two Chinese guys who were living in a rural village that had literally had all the trees cut down. You know, somebody'd harvested the lumber and wiped out the trees. And they were in their 50s and sort of feeling like their life was over. And one had lost his legs and the other was blind. So you got these two guys, you know, one's got no legs, one's blind. They're disabled and they're thinking, what can we do to help our town? You know, because we're sitting around, we might as well help our town. So they decided we're going to replant all the trees. So they had no money. And what they did was they got cuttings. And because they would travel around together, and the guy with no legs couldn't do anything, but he could see. And he could tell the guy who did have legs, who was blind, you know, what to do and how to do it. So wow. The two of them were this like a coin. They were a pair. So they got enough cuttings, and it took years to plant 10,000 trees. And all the trees died because they didn't know how to do it right. But through that process, they learned how to do it. And then they replanted them all again, and they caught. And the town was now flourishing because it had tons of trees. And wow. And you looked at their story and you thought, what is my excuse? What yeah. is my excuse?
Wow.
And, you know, yeah, because the blind guy would skinny up the trees to get the cuttings. And the guy with no legs who could see would sit on the ground and tell him, you know, another foot, go up here, go there. Anyway, and it reminds you, these guys got it in their head that they could save their town. No matter what their circumstance, they just got it in their head. And then they kept inventing and trying things until they finally figured it out. Do you know what I mean? Now, it reminds me of one of my other great Rappaport quotes that everybody's heard a million times. And that is, hopelessness is an op and it's planet wide. Didn't buy into the op.
Right.
Right.
And since they didn't, they only had one option after that. If you don't buy into that op, you're going to have to invent something better.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's what you're looking at, which is why a lot of people want to go for the op.
Right.
Because they're saying, well, look, if I stick with hopelessness, I won't have to invent something. Which right. I don't want to do that. So give me the hopelessness in my mind and soul. That's what I'm going to keep inventing. Hopeless, 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 hopeless. Right? Because then I'm buffered off from having to step out there and do something like be the blind guy or the guy with no legs.
Well, it gets worse because the folks who weren't willing to go to hopeless, they invented things like QAnon. So now we got hope porn to keep you on the couch, and it's like, I don't have to do anything because the QAnon troops are going to, you know, show up and reinvent my world and save everything. So I don't have to get busy.
Yeah, there is that too, right?
Right.
I think I should tell the Yeats story at this point because,
yes.
Well, like these two guys saved a village, Yeats's wife saved a marriage, a life. Right. Two lives, really. So Yeats, one of the great poets of all time, 52 years old, he's been pursuing a woman named Maud Gonne for decades to try to get her to marry him. She's his ideal, and she keeps turning him down and down and down. And finally, for the last time, I'm thinking 1928, I'm not sure if I got the date right. She turns him down. He knows she's going to turn him down. His final proposal is half-hearted. Her turn down is half-hearted. They're done. So he meets Georgie, 25 years old, highly intelligent, proposes marriage, she accepts. 4 days after the wedding, or if not sooner, she realizes this is a disaster. This marriage is doomed. It's not going to work out. We don't get the explanation. One can imagine why, whatever. At the same time, Yeats is poetically exhausted, I would say, at the end of his rope. The feeling you get, well, I've done everything I can do now. The language no longer holds any secrets for me. And what am I going to write? And my life is basically over, and so on and so forth. And, you know, on that note, he gets married to a 25-year-old. So 4 days after the wedding, she says to him, apparently out of the blue, you know, I've been experimenting with automatic writing, where I sit and I take dictation from various teachers and I write down whatever they tell me. And his ears perk up and he's intrigued. Really? She says, yes, let me show you. And she does. And what comes out on the page is, you know, if you were to read it, you would say indecipherable. I mean, what is this mean? What are they talking about? I have no idea. Words you've never seen before, juxtapositions, whatever. Whoa, you know. He's fascinated. Let's work together, he says. You keep on turning out the automatic writing. You and I devise these metaphysical systems to explain all of this, what it means, what it is, and so forth. And they proceed over the course of years now to work on this and come up with an unbelievable number of these systems, some of which nobody's ever even heard of, you know, diagrams and so forth. And a book is eventually published called A Vision, which contains much of this automatic writing, or some of it, 300 pages, which is nothing compared to all the output. Now, there are various scholars have made various explanations of this story about Georgie, the wife, and Yeats, the husband, and what really happened here. And the version that I prefer is she saw the marriage was doomed. No chance, probably the day after the wedding. 3 days later, she invents this pretext, I can do this thing called automatic writing, hoping that he will be interested. He is interested. She goes on to invent or whatever, you know, imagine tons and tons of output of this automatic writing, from which, by the way, Yeats, ever the watchful eye, carefully looks at, extracts fantastic phrases and words and key little passages, which he then twists around to incorporate in his new poems and gains new energy and life to write some of the greatest poems he's ever written, right?
Right.
And this is all her doing, really. She invents, in my version of the story, the whole shooting match. The marriage survives. They find love. They have two children. They stay together, all on the wings of invention.
Right.
This is like imagining. This is like the two guys in the village, one with no legs, one blind,
right,
who save the village. This is her, basically, with his eventual collaboration, saving the marriage, saving their lives, saving their time together, and catapulting his life's work into a new dimension.
And, you know, I hate to be the hyper-materialist investment banker I am, but she probably helped save their checkbook, too.
Probably, yeah.
Right.
You know, brilliant. I mean, desperate. Can you imagine?
Yes.
You know, you wake up the day after your wedding and you go, this is a disaster. This is not, you know, I just married this 52-year-old world-famous poet, and it's going to be a horror show. I can't possibly stay with him. What can I do?
Right.
I'll try this because I'm desperate and there's nothing else to invent that I can think of. And it works so brilliantly that, you know, lives are created on top
right.
of this.
Right. So there's a story I always tell. You're probably sick of me telling it, but I love it. It was the time I interviewed you on The Matrix Revealed, and I had three different phones and three different power sources, and there was so much interference. I was in a hotel in California that I had to use all three phones and all three power sources during the whole interview, and I was so proud of myself because you never noticed that. I mean, can you imagine all the electricity in a hotel room went out? I couldn't believe it.
I had no idea.
It was a great interview. But anyway, so it was on your collection, The Matrix Revealed, and the interviews I love so much, the Ellis Metavoy interviews. And, you know, so for those of you who don't know John's interviews, for many years he would give these in-depth interviews to people who'd been high up in the machinery of control, Mr. Global's machinery. You know, so it'd be a priest from a Vatican or a PR guy. You know, I always thought Ellis Metavoy probably worked for the Executive Committee and the Council of Foreign Relations. And you were deeply interested in the nuts and bolts of how control is created and how official realities are simulated, all of these. Anyway, and they were fascinating. I would wait every week for my next interview because I just love them. Anyway, so I was telling people about them. And we were talking about the Ellis Metavoy interviews of sort of how our world is simulated and created, and, you know, sort of our official reality. And the next week I had a subscriber contact me and say, you know, I've always gone to all these New Age seminars where they tell you that you can invent your world. And I always went and I never got anything. But it was by hearing John Rappaport explain how Mr. Global invents my world for me, I realized, oh, I can invent my world. You know, if Mr. Global can invent this simulation, then I can too. And she said, it's by seeing how I've allowed my world to be invented for me, you know, that I've realized I do have this power and I can do it too. And it was quite remarkable.
That was my point. I mean, that's right. Why I wanted to really do those interviews, to show. You see how they're doing it? So, you know.
Let's do it. We can do it too.
We can do it too, right? Let's you and I simulate, you know. And then you say, well, yeah, we started off, it was a simulation, but now it isn't anymore. Now it's as real can get. And that's the thing, you know, there's like a crossover moment when you realize it's not just imagination anymore. It's now the imagination has become reality. And it's not as if I just thought it and then it suddenly appeared on my desk. You know, there's work involved. I mean, you know, you have a vision, you pursue it and so on. But then you look back and you say, well, look at what we did here. We started off with an idea and imagining. And now this time later, here it is. It's real. It's happened.
Right. And the revolution starts when we all say, you know something, I reject the world you're inventing for me. I prefer to invent my own. And that starts with the sovereign individual, as opposed to us all buying into the great schmush. That's what I call it. When you give one of these rants about the, you know, the Borg, why we all have to join the Borg for the greater good. I call it the great schmush. So just walk us through, if we want to learn more about your work, if we want to read your work. I try to get the emails, you know, they're always blocking your emails. I have a long history. Yeah. But just walk through how we access your work, how we access the imagination work and the exercises. Just walk us through how we get your stuff.
Well, the site is nomorefakenews.com. It's been there now for 20 years. I can't believe that, but it's true. And once you go there, you'll see three graphics, the Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. Each one of these is a huge collection, and each one in its own way has to do with ultimately imagining and inventing the world that you really want.
Right.
And so that's the easiest way to, you know, order these, access these. And it goes back also to what we were saying at the beginning here. What is the thing you have the most faith in? Because then that is going to lead you to, this is what I want to imagine. Okay, I can see it. You can see it. I've had people say this to me, you know, this is what I imagine. And they explain it to me, and I say, well, it's very clear to me. I hope it's as clear to you. You're the one who imagined it. So what are you waiting for? You know, I'm just looking here at Blake again. He who doubts from what he sees will ne'er believe. Do what you please. If the sun and moon should doubt, they'd immediately go out. Right. You know, to see the world, to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
That's one of my favorites from Blake.
Yeah. I mean, if that doesn't inspire you to say, oh, yeah, there's more to my world than I thought there was, then I can't help you. You know, to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. One of the things I say here in the article on Blake is that he could take a nursery rhyme kind of rhythm and elevate it all the way to heaven.
Yes.
I mean, that is something I've never seen before in any poet, to have that ability where you don't look back afterwards and say, well, that was just a nursery rhyme. No. He's just taking that easy rhythm and he's saying, okay, now I'm going to take this and I'm going to make it infinite. Okay, sure. Here you go.
In my first year of college, I took a full year course on the Romantics. So it was a full year of studying the Romantics. And it was also a full year of studying Shakespeare. So I took full year Shakespeare and full year Romantics. One of the best educational experiences of my life. And so I really studied the Romantics. I love the Romantics. When I was preparing for this conversation with you today, one of the things I noted that in 2002, the BBC did a poll of the 100 greatest Britons, and Blake came up 38, and I think he's the only Romantic on the list. Way ahead. I did a search for Wordsworth. Where's Wordsworth? I couldn't believe Wordsworth, I don't think, was even on the list. Shakespeare was number 5, and Blake was the first, you know, poet. I mean, Shakespeare was a poet, but Blake was the first, certainly the first Romantic and the first poet. And I realized, you know, that's remarkable that someone as transcendent and energetic as Blake is that popular.
Yes.
And he is.
And something similar happened. I mean, it wouldn't be the case anymore at all, but something similar happened in America with Walt Whitman.
Yes.
People, you know, bought his book, Leaves of Grass by the Ton. He became a hero. Well, go ahead and read Song of Myself or I Sing the Body Electric and see what he's actually saying.
It's very transcendent.
Wow.
Wow.
You know? And there you have it. And now, I mean, you look at what's happening with the lockdowns and the masks and the vaccine and the thing, and, you know, the most dismal, vicious, horrendous, materialistic program.
Yeah, whatever you're seeing in art, it, you know, vision, faith, imagination, the goal is to destroy it. This is, if you've ever watched The Never Ending Story, this is the nothing. The nothing is on the march. And they are literally trying to persuade you that there is nothing. They're trying to destroy all meaning.
Exactly what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, if you were to take, I don't know, 500 churches where the pastors know that they're boring. You know, they're willing to admit, okay, people sleep, and say, look, read Whitman. Don't give a sermon. Read William Blake. Read Yeats. Right. Read Dylan Thomas. Just read them, you know, out loud. Give it all you've got. Something's going to happen to these people. When they hear a certain line, somebody's going to go, oh, wait a minute. Some kid is going to wake up and say, you know, who's 12 years old, and he'll never forget that Sunday, and it's going to change his life.
Right.
I mean, this is the power of these people that, well, what are you talking about? The romantics, and so we don't have time. Yeah, because
you do. You need to know where your power is going to come from.
Because it's all buried in the cellar. You got to just take it out of the cellar and put it out there, and then you'll see people going, to see the world in a grain of sand, heaven and wildflower. Wow. Read that again. Where did you get that from? And, you know, not everybody, but there's going to be some people that, you know, yeah, I remember reading something like that once. And, you know, lives change on that basis.
So before we close, can I read you one of my favorite poems?
Please.
I gotta find it. Because I love Blake, but this is very apropos of what you have given into our lives so many times, John. Okay, so it's from Robert Penmore, and it's called Tell Me a Story. So, you know, I live in Tennessee. You live in the South now, so this is very Southern. Long ago in Kentucky, I, a boy, stood by a dirt road in first dark and heard the great geese hoot northward. I could not see them, there being no moon and the stars sparse. I heard them. I did not know what was happening in my heart. It was the season before the elderberry blooms, therefore they were going north. The sound was passing northward. Tell me a story. In this century and moment of mania, tell me a story. Make it a story of great distances and starlight. The name of the story will be time, but you must not pronounce its name. Tell me a story of deep delight.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, John Rappaport, we love you to pieces.
Love you too, Catherine.
Every time I turn around, I call you my food dog because you back up the nothing. Any last words for us before we sign off?
No, I think the poem does it all. I really love the, you know, being able to sit here and talk with you about this. Just so great. Thank you so much.
Love you.
Love you too.